Let's just see if God's saying anything else before we get started. Probably is, but we can get going anyway. He's always talking, hey? Amen. Hey, thanks for the book, by the way. They gave me a book when I got here. It was helpful for writing notes. As I was sitting in worship, I was like, God starts swapping stuff around to me. So cool. At the start of this year, the start of each year, I seek the Lord and I just take time and stop and seek God for what he has to say for the year, particularly for our family and our church. But something that I felt God saying was to me individually, but I know it's wider than just for me. It was, I was walking my dog. Again, this dog is a prayer warrior. She's probably responsible for more salvations than most people going around. And we're out walking there's this dip, there's a big trench cut sort of near here, and at about eye level, there was a hummingbird, a colourful hummingbird just sitting there. Now, I've done a lot of drugs, so I always sort of don't know if I'm hallucinating or not when stuff happens. So I'm looking at this hummingbird, it was just sitting there even, and the colours were brilliant, there was all these sort of colours, and I'm looking at this thing, and I'm thinking, oh my goodness, am I hallucinating, is this a vision, or is it just a real bird that just happens to be there? And don't get me wrong, I don't hallucinate regularly, so I'm not saying it's just like a normal thing that happens, but it's in the realm of possibility. And this bird was sitting there, and I was just like, whoa, what is going on there? And I felt God, as I was walking off, and I was just trying to just work out if what was it about? Was it real? Was it from God? Was it just a cool thing? And I felt God saying, I want to bless you in colourful ways. And I didn't like that, because I like things done my way. Like, I want to be blessed like this, nice and clean, and pick my numbers and pick the thing and all of it. But God's saying, Jacob, let me be in control. Trust. Essentially, what he was saying was, trust me. Essentially, what he was saying was, trust that my way is better than your way. And the scripture says that his ways are higher than our ways. That his way of living, his way of thinking, his ways are higher than our ways. And that means better. Better. It's better. And you have to yield to that. We need to yield to that better, that his way is better. And as I was walking along, I'm still just wrestling with that thought and just trying to really lay it down. I've been walking with God now for about 15 years. And my whole journey has been this wrestle, really, with just trusting God. I think I'm probably not alone. I think that's the human wrestle, is trusting God. And I felt God saying, just let me do it my way. Trust me that my way is better. Trust me. And as I was walking along and wrestling with that, and I just laid it down. And then, do you have like those times where it's like fully Holy Spirit anointed and inspired, and you're getting the prophetic and it's flowing, and yeah, God's talking to me, and then it sort of dries up and you're back in reality, and it's like, hang on, did I just imagine all that? Was that all just like me just, making up words in my head and thinking stuff, and then now I'm like, oh. And then I was like, God, was that you speaking to me? And that was about the same time as I was walking back past the spot where I had seen the bird, and then the bird came up and it sat at eye level again. And then another one came and sat at eye level, and that's where I've really felt God saying, this word is not just for you, it's for others. And I did see that bird a couple of times again, so we're still not sure whether it was real or not. I have Googled whether they live in Australia, they don't. So I'm not sure what the story is. Maybe there are some escaped pets or something. I don't know. But I really felt God saying is, trust me, trust me. And my journey with God was, I grew up, my parents got saved out of drugs when I was 2. My mum was pregnant with my older brother when she was 16. She had him just a couple of days after she turned 17. She was pregnant with me again and had me at 19. While she was pregnant with me, she married my dad. And they were married for... until I was about 13. And all around the time of 13, so we had a great life. I was an A student through school. I was a champion boy for all the age groups in athletics. I went to high school on a sports scholarship. And as far as I was concerned, I was going to the Olympics. That was it. That was locked in my brain. That was all. There was no other option for me as far as I was concerned. I'd spent since I was a young boy, since even before school age, I wouldn't eat junk food hardly because I was conscious of my body, because I was conscious of focusing on this Olympic dream, even from like 5, 6 years of age. You know, even at that age, I'd be doing laps or up sprints up and down my street. And as I was older, I'd do laps around the block. And at lunchtime and recess, I'd be doing sprints and in the playground just to, because I was so focused that this was my where I was going to get there. When I was 13, I started a hockey scholarship, and there'd be I trained at the Commonwealth Hockey Stadium four times a week, and played there on a Saturday. This is as a 13-year-old boy. There'd be times where we would have the Australian hockey team having half of the pitch and we would have the other half, and I'd get to literally meet my dream. I literally got to shake hands with my dream on a regular basis. And as far as I was concerned, that was locked down. It was locked in. But then around the age of 12, 13, a few sort of things happened. The first thing was that my parents separated. And the second thing that happened was my knees went. And I remember around this time looking at my life, which I'd gone to church every single Sunday. Like for us, church was a non-negotiable growing up. It was a non-negotiable. If we had a birthday party on a Sunday morning, we didn't go to that party. That was just this is the priority. And I loved church. I loved being in there. We grew up in a great church in Perth, and I just really enjoyed it. But I started to struggle, and I expect a lot of teenage boys do. I looked at what the other guys were doing my age, what the people I was looking up to were doing, and I grew up in a neighbourhood where there was a lot of gang activity, a lot of drugs, a lot of that was normal, and I started to feel like I was missing out. I started to feel like by living this life in Christ, in church, doing things right, that I was being ripped off, that I was missing out, that I was getting less than the best. And so from that point, I sort of made a decision. This is earlier on, and this is before it ever actually came out, but somewhere in my heart, I sort of I had a feeling that I was missing out. And I never had that answered in my heart, my soul, that God's plan was best. And then as the year unfolded, I was really struggling with my friends because I did sport with them and my mates, and I wasn't able to do that anymore. So I wasn't spending time with those guys anymore. At home, things got tipped upside down as my dad left, and that security and that I used to find at home, that approval that I used to get from my dad, I didn't have that. So I started to look for somewhere to belong. I started to look for somewhere to be accepted. I started those things that are so key to a young man, and I expect to most people. And I couldn't find them. And where I sort of settled was with my older brother and his mates. Now, these guys had started to use drugs. They were just smoking pot and doing petty crime at the time, doing graffiti and just selling. You say the word just because it's not that it's insignificant, but compared to things further down, it's a lot less destructive. And I started hanging out with these guys. And what started to happen was I had never, ever had a desire to use drugs. Like I said earlier, I had been so respectful of my body, so invested in looking after my body that I had no desire to wreck it. I knew what drugs did to you. I grew up in a neighborhood where it was so much destruction. My family, uncles and aunties, are drug addicts. I see it. I saw it. Drug ed in school. They taught us drugs are bad. Don't do drugs. They wreck your life. You know, the stuff we all got in school. And so I'd never had any desire, but as I was hanging out with these guys, I desperately wanted to fit in. And I felt like I didn't really fit because I wasn't using the drugs that they were using. We're listening to a lot of hip-hop music, and this music is extremely destructive. This music was saying that violence is how you get respect, drugs are cool, and disrespecting women is acceptable. And this is what we're listening to just day in, day out. And for those that don't understand the power of music, what do you think we spend half an hour in a morning? First, we start the day at church with music. It's powerful. It's powerful. It opens your soul up and connects you. So when we're listening to music, young people, as a young person, I was listening to that music. my mind was being eroded. And I had the, I listened to one particular, there was a song that was one of my favorite songs at the time, and there's a line in it that said, when you smoke, talking about marijuana, when you smoke like I smoke, then you're high like every day, was the line. And I thought, you know what, I don't even smoke pot. And I'm identifying with these guys in the music. I'm hanging out with all these guys that are doing it. And I felt like I just really didn't belong. Now, these guys had never pressured me to try drugs, never teased me for not being part. They never made me feel less than. They'd never communicated that whatsoever. But from the music and from just wanting to belong and being so desperate to belong, I formed that opinion that I needed to try this drug to fit in. I thought what I would do is I'll try it. There's no way that I would like it because drugs are stupid. They wreck your life. And then when the bong got passed my way, next time I'll just say, no thanks, I don't like it. It's not that I'm a chicken because I've never tried it or anything like that. There would always be smoking like multiple times a day. And the next time was at the bus stop on our way home from school. I was 13 years old. The bong got passed to me. And instead of passing it on, I tried some. And two things happened that day. The first thing is what I'd hoped for, that I'd feel like I really belonged. And I did. The second thing was that I got stoned. And I liked it. No one had prepared me for the fact that I might enjoy this experience. And in fact, I liked it. What happened to me was the heartbreak of my dad leaving, which at the time I wouldn't have even identified that it was there and that it was present and that it was large in my life, but I just felt it go. The disappointment of losing my Olympic dream, I just felt it go. And all of a sudden I felt good. For the first time in a long time, I felt good. And I actually made the decision, 13 years of age, the very first time I tried marijuana, if I can just keep feeling like this, everything will be okay. I was literally addicted the very first time I tried it. Some people will tell you that marijuana is not addictive. I'll tell you they have no idea what they're talking about. They have no idea. In fact, at that point, I decided, wow, if pot's this good, I wonder how good all the other drugs are. And from that point on, I started to use drugs daily, started to smoke marijuana multiple times a day, and started to experiment with speed and acid and binge drinking, and started smoking cigarettes and different things like that. But I came up with a problem very, very early on, was I could not afford to purchase drugs daily. The guys I was hanging around with came up with a solution where they organized for me to sell drugs to my friends in my year group for them, and I would get it for free. And this went on for a few years where I was basically high most of the time, hanging out with these older guys, feeling like I belonged, feeling like I was, like it was really, that initial hunger, ache that I had to fit in and belong seemed to have been satisfied. Until about the age of 16, where it was almost like the drugs stopped working, where it didn't matter how much I smoked or how much I drank or how much I used. The high wouldn't go higher than my pain. It wouldn't go higher than my disappointment. It wouldn't go higher than the ache in me. It was like it stopped working. So I made the decision that I was going to try injecting. Now, all the guys I'd been hanging around, the older guys, they'd been injecting for years now. And again, they'd never ever encouraged it for me. In fact, they'd been done the exact opposite. They'd said to me, Jacob, if I ever find out that you're on the needle, I'm going to flog you. Don't touch it. So I went behind their back and I tried injecting for the first time. I was 16 years old. I shot speed. 2 weeks later, I shot heroin. I had that exact feeling that I had at 13 when I tried marijuana. If I can just keep feeling like this, everything will be okay. Except I knew now what that meant. I knew that if I was going to use heroin daily, that would be a serious, serious addiction. But the thing was, is I didn't care. I didn't see another option. I did not see another option. I was already, I figured, hopelessly addicted. And again, I used the same solution that I used originally to pay for my drugs. I started to sell. At 17, I was selling enough heroin to keep myself high most of the time, if not all of the time. I thought I had everything that I wanted as a young guy, where I decided that having this respect, belonging was what life was about. Having money in my pocket, being popular was what life was about. And at that point, the same thing that had happened earlier happened again. The drug stopped working. I couldn't get higher than my pain. I couldn't get higher than the brokenness inside me. And I found myself at this place where now I was addicted to heroin. I knew heroin addicts. I had uncles and aunties that had been addicted their entire life. I knew guys in their 50s and 60s that were still addicted. They're on methadone now, a government artificial substitute for heroin. And this was, I thought, this is my life. This is what I had to look forward to. And I wasn't happy. I had a lifetime of misery ahead of me. My friends had started to die from overdoses. They started to get diseases from needles. They started to go to prison, started to get kicked out of home. And I looked at my life and I thought, what hope do I have? And why wait for death to come? So I attempted suicide. I'm grateful every day that it didn't work, but I was put in Greylands Mental Institution. It was the second time I'd been there by this point. When I got out of that hospital, nothing changed. Nothing. I went back to my life. Absolutely hopeless. There was a lot of people will hear my story and hear about that moment. The truth of it is that that wasn't the only time I attempted suicide. I had an overdose, which I'll walk you through shortly. But people will look at these moments and they'll say, often, is that where you hit rock bottom? Is that when you realized you needed help? Is that where you put your hand up and said, I need help? But none of that was it. None of that was it. My lowest point, my rock bottom, was driving along the freeway under King's Park, and a song came on the radio, and the lyrics of this song said, were you born to be a star? Were you born to be more than you are? And I broke. Not externally. If you had been sitting next to me, you would have no idea, but inside, a lesson broke. It went. I was emptied. I looked at my future, and I knew deep inside that I was called for more. I knew that I was called for something significant. I knew that I had been put on planet Earth for a reason. I had to have been. Yet there was now no way I was ever going to get there. From that point on, I was just like a walking shell, trying to fill myself with drugs, with adventure, with different things that would try and validate me, that would try, and literally I was doing time and I knew it. I was literally doing time until I died. And I knew it, and I was so aware of that feeling where I would just, every single day, I would use as much drugs as I possibly could, hoping that I would die. I would walk across roads. I would not even look left or right. I was hoping I was going to get hit by a bus. I was just doing time. I was at a party one night, 19 years of age, like any other night, when we went back to a friend's house. In the middle of the night, someone woke my friend and they said, Jacob's snoring too loud, I can't wake him, can you come wake him? So he's came out and he's heard this noise that they said was snoring. He's immediately recognized what this noise was. A year earlier, one of the guys that we had hung out with every single day, he lived in the same block as us. And they were watching a movie, doing drugs. This guy fell asleep. My friend thought he started to snore. After a while, he realized something was wrong and he rang the ambulance. The guy wouldn't wake up. He rang the ambulance. By the time the ambulance got there, he was dead. 18 years of age. He wasn't snoring. He was gurgling. He was drowning in his vomit. So when he's come out and heard this noise that they'd said was me snoring, he knew instantly that it was not snoring, that I was drowning. He rang the ambulance. By the time the ambulance got to his home, I was dead. They used the defibrillators, it woke, start my heart again. They did that a few more times through the night. My mum was called and asked to sign my organs away for donation. My mum's a woman of faith, and she said no. And she prayed. I made it through. Long story short, I was in a coma for a week. When I woke up, I had to learn how to walk again. I had to learn how to breathe again. They came in and told me that it's impossible that I'm alive. The head of the department came in, and a lot of the guys wouldn't even come across the threshold of my room into my room. Staff would stop at the door, and I would notice, why are you stopping at the door, not crossing? The guy came in, and he was on the other side. And he said, someone up there is looking out for you. Now, as a kid, I believed in God. I loved God. I was raised in church, and I believe I had a relationship with God to some extent. But I hadn't believed in God for a long time. In my mind, that was, and if he even was there, I didn't think he was very interested in me. I remember my mum in the room. Apparently she sat by my bed for a week, but I only saw her once when I woke. A counselor had come in and she said, you need help for your problem, for your drug problem. And I said, lady, I don't have a problem. I like using drugs. My mum came in after that. I could see she was heartbroken. I remember trying to feel bad. I remember trying so, so hard to feel bad. I tried as hard as I could to feel bad, and there was nothing there. It was nothing. As soon as I learned to walk, I walked out of the hospital and went back to my old life. 2 years forward, 21 now, I was living in this nice two-story place, selling a lot of drugs, party every night. I wasn't needing to buy drugs anymore. They were all just free. Except for some reason that night, there was some ecstasy going around and I didn't know the dealer. And I wanted some, so I decided I was going to buy some. The only money I had on me was my rent for the next day. So I spent some of that on ecstasy that night, thinking, no worries, it'll be very easy to get $50 the next day. But for whatever reason, the next morning, instead of going and getting the money, how I normally would have gotten it, I went to my mum's school. My mum's a school teacher. I went to my mum's school and I asked her for the money. I'd never asked her for money since I'd left home at 17 years of age. And she said to me, Jacob, I'll give you the money. She put it in my real estate agent's account. She said, but I don't want to see you again until you're in rehab. I thought, once a junkie, always a junkie. I thought, you don't get out of this. I didn't know one person that had ever gotten out. Except I heard one girl tell her story years earlier. Like me standing here now, she said that she was in a situation like I was, addicted to heroin. And she went to a place called Teen Challenge and God had changed her life. I was sitting at the back of that auditorium. So I hadn't lived at home since I was 17, but I would still like to catch up with my mum. We'd go for a meal and I still very, very, very much valued her. And this, she was at a seminar. She's a school teacher. She was at a seminar near my home and she invited me to it. So I went along, I was sitting up the back, and when this woman had said that she had been off drugs off heroin for a certain amount of years. As loud as I'm speaking to you now, minus the microphone, obviously, I'll paraphrase and say bull dust. She either never was a junkie or she still uses it in the closet. Once a junkie, always a junkie. So when it came time, Mum said about rehab, and I thought, once a junkie, always a junkie. I thought, there's no getting out of this. I do not get out of here alive. I used to even have a Jim Morrison poster on my wall that said, "No one here gets out alive." It was what I thought my future was. And she said about rehab, and I thought, you know what? I'm going to give it a proper go. And when it doesn't work, I'm going to go back to my life and go harder than ever, push it so hard that I die quicker. So when I've gone to these, I've went first to the first meeting to try and arrange to get into a rehab. Long story short, they wouldn't let me get into one because of the amount of drugs I was using. They said that I need to get my drug use down to a certain level before I'd be able to even go into the detox clinic to get it down to another level where I'd be able to go into a residential center. And I was thinking, if I could use less drugs, I wouldn't need you people. And I went away, and for the first time, I actually wanted to stop because they told me I couldn't. And I remember that was the first day I ever felt scared for so long. I remember being scared that a car was going to hit me, because now I had a vision, I had a dream, I was going to do something. I went the following week, and there was a different lady there. And I'm talking to her, and I'm thinking, she's asking me the same questions that the first lady had asked, and I think, I'm not going to tell you the truth. I'll tell you exactly what you want to hear. And I told her I was using significantly less drugs than I was, and she recommended Teen Challenge to me, and I immediately remembered that this was the place that girl who had spoken about was. The only one I'd ever heard of getting off was the same place, and I said to her, "Are you a Christian? Are you trying to push God on me?" And she said, "No, no, no, we'll find you somewhere else." But in that split second between me saying, "You're trying to push God on me," and between her saying no, it can't have been even a second. In that split moment, in that fraction, it's like, I made a deal with God. I spoke to God for the first time in a long time. I said, "God, if you're real, you can make me stop wanting to use drugs." I said, "And if you do that, I will serve you for the rest of my life." Then she cuts in, "No, no, 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 we'll find you somewhere else." And I'm like, "No, give me the God place." And she's like, "No, no, no." And I was like, "Give me the God place." And I'm not really sure about too much after that, but I ended up, an interesting side note with the story is the following week I've gone in and I said, "Oh, I want to talk to the lady I was talking to last week." And she said, "What lady's that?" I said, "You were sick, so they sent someone else in." They said, "We don't send people in when we're sick. We don't get people from the outside. We just get someone else from it." And they couldn't. And she's gotten out really concerned, going around asking about who was this lady that had seen me. She didn't exist. There was no record of somebody working from there. She didn't exist. So that following week when I'm there, I'm like, "I want to go to Teen Challenge." They're like, "You don't want to go to Teen Challenge. It's too strict. You're not this." And I'm like, "I don't." And I think, "I don't need you people anymore." And I rang my mum and said, "Mum, I want to go to Teen Challenge." And I don't remember much from that point. Apparently there was a few meetings, which I don't remember really any of it. But at 21 years of age, I ended up at Teen Challenge. Have we had pictures going as we've been talking? Yeah, cool. At 21 years of age, I ended up down there, and it was a 10-hour bus ride, which you think's a long way. And then when I get to the bus, then they collect me in a car and we drive like another half hour into the darkness. The guy that picked me up was, because by now I knew Teen Challenge was a Christian place, and the guy that picked me up was this real clean-cut Vietnamese guy. And I just, for some reason, I hated him. I was like, "You little church boy, what do you know about where I've been? It's like you've never even had Panadol." And on that car ride, I was talking with him. And he'd been in the gangs as well. He'd been a heroin addict for 5 years like I had been. He'd run around and done all the sort of stuff that I'd been doing. And that was when I thought, wow, this is a possibility. This is a real possibility. And for the first time, I felt like I had hope. Long story short, I was really, really sick, because I was coming down off, like, I think I was literally using like 5 or 6 different drugs every day, different types of drugs multiple times a day. I was really, really sick for weeks. I didn't sleep for months properly. Literally, it took me about 8 months before I was able to sleep through the night. And it was that process was pretty horrific. But the hard bit was learning how to live again. I hadn't had to experience my own emotions since I was 13. And I had to deal with a lot of the stuff, a lot of the brokenness that was why I needed the drugs to cover the pain, to cover the brokenness. I went through that. But very early on, so what works at Teen Challenge like this, it's like in the morning, they've got all this structure, but then they've got church, and then you go to a class, and there's a men's classroom and a ladies' classroom, and you've got to sit in there, and just whatever stage you're at, then you start with the work at, so you get there day one, there's particular work that they give day one guys sort of thing. Except I was, by the first time that I was able to go to a classroom, and I was actually well enough to go into the classroom. There was this point where the words said, the forms was like, do you want to let Jesus be the Lord, the leader of your life? And I knew I wanted the outcome. I knew I wanted, and to be very, very honest, I didn't want to stop using drugs. I just didn't want the bad stuff attached to it. I knew, because I'd grown up in church, I'd grown up in a good home, I was raised right. I knew what it meant to be a Christian. And I knew I wanted it, but it just didn't seem so easy for me to say yes. So it was like that bit of work sat there for a few days while I was just really contemplating. It's like I knew I was going to say yes. I knew I was going to, but I still had to. Remember, we started by saying trusting that God's plan is better. Reaching the point where I was actually going to give into that and actually take that leap of faith. And that's what it is. It's a leap of faith. And then I made that step of faith. And I remember it was a few days later, I was sitting by a fire. So at Teen Challenge, this like, you're just deprived of everything. No TV, no fridge. I mean, like, they got a fridge in the kitchen, but you don't have one, like, in your room. You've just got everything's on a timetable. It's really, like, it's just cut back to basics. You're just back to the essentials. And they'd have dessert two nights a week. And everyone would get really excited about dessert night. And I remember when I got there, I was like, I am never, ever going to be excited about dessert night. Because I was too cool, you know. And it was like a Tuesday night or Thursday. That was always dessert night. And they were doing that. And everyone's excited. And I was just sitting back by the fire because I was always so cold. My bones were still cold. My body was hot. But I was sitting by this fire just keeping warm. I remember the jacket that I had on. And the sleeve of this jacket had been stitched up because we're in a fight one night. My friend was wearing my jacket and he had stabbed a guy a dozen times. And he cut up the sleeve of my jacket while he was doing it. Instead of throwing it out, I just stitched it up. I was wearing that jacket, sitting by this fire, watching people happy about ice cream and cake. And then I felt this feeling, and I started to freak out. And there's something within me told me, don't freak out. And this feeling was like waves. It was just like feeling everything was going to be okay. Like I was safe. I was feeling secure, content, happy, joy. The first time I'd felt this joy, this peace, this security since I was a little boy. I recognized it. And I promise you guys, that feeling has never left me. I went through the program and one of the things that they'll tell you down there is it's not about the program, it's about Jesus. It's about Jesus. If you don't meet Jesus, experience Jesus, let Jesus do what he needs to do, you're wasting your time there. And I went through that program and had a radical, radical encounter with Jesus. Gave my life to him. I honored my word, up until this point at least, that if he would make me stop wanting to use drugs, that I would serve him for the rest of my life. After I finished the program, I did an internship and then I was offered the opportunity to go on staff. And I worked down there for 2 years, which was just the hugest privilege for me. Tremendous, tremendous privilege. For me, the biggest privilege was when the guys would come in and they'd look at me the way I looked at that Vietnamese guy. Look at this church boy, what does he know about me? And every now and again, some of my old mates would come through and they couldn't believe it. I'm going to be really quick with the last bit, which is all the really good stuff. Like, that's cool. But the really good stuff is that I've never used a drug since the day I got to Teen Challenge. I've been clean for 14 plus years now. My little brother, who started using drugs when he was 9, first busted for selling when he was 10, was shooting up from about the age of 13 or 14. He went through Teen Challenge when he was 24. My older brother, who was shooting up from about the age of 14, 15, addicted to heroin for 20 plus years. He graduated Teen Challenge last week. Yeah. 22 years of prayer from my mum. God can do anything. God can do it. When I very first got down there and God started to work on me, he put one of my friends on my heart to pray for. This guy was... he was like the baddest kid in my year. See, the reason I was hanging out with my brother and my older mates wasn't because of my brother, it was because of this guy. Me and him were hanging out with them, or they were his friends, and I was hanging out. God put him on my heart to pray for him. And I said, God, you don't understand. You don't know Aaron Price. You don't know this man. He was doing jail for armed robbery at the time. And today... he's a pastor of a church in Perth. When we go to pastors' meetings, we know each other from when we were kids. The other guys know each other when they're kids, from Youth Alive and doing all stuff like that. We used to sell drugs and rob people together. God can reach anyone. God can do anything. There's nothing he can't do. There's nothing he can't do.